Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest tonight is writer, journalist, media historian, Jennifer Keeshan Armstrong. And we're talking about her book, Seinfeldia, How a Show About Nothing Changed Everything. Jennifer, welcome back. It's a real pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Thank you so much for having me.
I want to say right up front, I was a little bit skeptical going in. Because you figure, you know, I see these books all the time about big TV shows. And, you know, one of the biggest is Seinfeld. And I go, well, you know. And this is actually a really interesting, fascinating book because it's about how a very original show got produced, got written, and the problems it had with the networks.
Exactly. I mean, I appreciate that, of course, most people who read this book or any of my books about television, you know, they're going to be fans of the thing I'm writing about. I get that. But I actually try to write books almost as if you could read it and not and be from outer space. You know what I mean? And like enjoy the actual narrative. And the thing about Seinfeld is it was a huge show, but there was also a story to be told, which is what you just summarized there, right? Like the show that should not have ever worked became one of the biggest shows of all time.
Yeah, and what was really interesting, and we'll talk a little bit about this, is how the network reacted along the way, where they were very skeptical in the beginning. But let's one of the other things this book is about how the show just infiltrated popular culture. And as you say in the book, the show ended in 1998, and here we are almost two and a third decades later, and it's still really popular, and people obsess about it.
Exactly, and I have to tell you, I'm kind of excited because it's coming to Netflix this year, and I think it's going to get a whole new bump, which will be incredible. I would be really surprised if that didn't happen. The kind of similar thing that happened to Friends a few years ago, where literally people who hadn't been born, you know, when was on, started loving it. And I know that this is slightly different, but I think it's going to find its Netflix audience, and I think it's going to have a whole new revival in people's lives and in culture.
I've always watched it in reruns, and whenever I come across it, I'll watch an episode even though I've seen it n number of times.
Yep.
But one of the things I also realized, and this just happened to me just before I came down the studio, you know, I was watching an episode of Friends just in comparison, and there is no comparison. The whole tone and gestalt of the show now seems more radical than ever.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, you know from the book that Friends comes up a lot.
Yeah, and, yeah, but there's there's no comparison because I never get that weird charge out of a Friends episode. And it always seems so tame. And like, I'm never worried that they're going to do something. I'm not worried. I'm never expecting something to really walk up to the line and probably cross it.
Right, exactly. And so it became this kind of thing, and it still is among some people, that it's like you're either a Friends or a Seinfeld person. And
I can see that. It's cats and dogs.
Right? There is a little bit of a personality test inherent in it. But Friends is very, very mainstream. It's very like khaki pants.
It really is. And it wallows in its mainstreamness.
Right, exactly, exactly. It's very sweet. You know, the whole thing about Seinfeld's secret motto was...
They're both populated by despicable characters. But I'll tell you, I want to hang out with the Seinfeld characters. I don't want to hang out with the Friends characters.
I mean, that's a really good point. I think the Seinfeld characters are more overt about that. I think they know they're despicable.
It's a different kind of kink. It's a different kind of weirdness. And I think it has to be the New York sensibility.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It is it's surprisingly New York for a show that is technically not shot in New York.
I mean, we got to get into some of the things because there's so much in this book, and we're obviously just going to scratch the surface.
Right.
Now, Jerry Seinfeld and Larry David, and some people who don't know him are going to find this sort of interesting. They had been friends since the 70s, and they were both stand-up comics. And people might find the idea of Larry David doing stand-up comedy to be bizarre.
Yeah, and I mean, my understanding of it, limited as it is, because, you know, you can only see so much of it. You had to really be there. But my understanding is they all said he was a comic, which, acquired taste.
What does that really mean? Does that mean most people in the general audience are not going to find it funny?
Yes. Okay. Yes. that is definitely, he has a very specific sensibility, which I think we all now understand.
Yeah.
But especially then, but I would say, you know, yeah, he wasn't Jerry. You know, Jerry is exactly the opposite in his comedy. It's like, yeah, he's so mainstream.
How did the two of them decide to make a television show together?
So Jerry was approached by NBC because that was typical, like especially then, even maybe now to some extent, if you did really well on one of their late night talk shows, you know, you'd be approached eventually by an executive who'd say, what ideas do you have? Do you want to do a special? Do you want to, you know, do a sitcom? What do you got? And so he just thought, take the meeting, I'll do it. Sure. But he didn't have any ideas. And he really felt like it was an opportunity he should jump on if he could. And he decided to consult Larry after, you know, they both did sets one night at a stand-up show. And because he thought, like, I know this guy, Larry, he's really cool. And Larry had done some writing for television on a show called Fridays, which was like, yep, a Saturday Night Live ripoff at the time. And so he basically was like, well, this guy has at least written something for television. I'll ask him. And that's essentially how it all started.
What's fascinating throughout your book is Larry David trying to deal with executives at the network, because it just doesn't, no matter what they would say, you know, he's against it.
Yep.
And he takes it as a personal criticism.
Yep, exactly. And I think in a weird way, his dealing with them is one of the X factors in this show that shouldn't have gotten as far as it did. Getting as far as it did, because if it really was not popular at first, and he was in no position to be arguing with them, it was not popular. But the thing was, he didn't really care if he kept this job, and so that was the key. And I think we can all learn something from that was really the key.
I don't know. I'm really afraid what that lesson is, but
I mean, it's that he wasn't groveling the way they were so used to all the other creators being like, okay, I'll do whatever you say. And he was just like, I'm just trying to serve my art, which is kind of an annoying trait at times in people. But like, it really served him well that he was constantly kind of like, also not just that, but also very like, it seems really hard to make a show. Maybe I don't really want to do this. Like, he was always saying he'd already run out of material. It was like episode 4. He was like, I can't keep thinking of stuff. I don't really want to keep doing this. And it gave him this power to just constantly say to them, when they'd say, why don't you change the show this way? He'd be like, no, thanks. I'll just walk away.
Well,
the power of being able to walk away was everything.
As you're writing your book, every year, it seemed from the beginning, Jerry had to like sort of beg him to return for the next season.
Exactly. He really, especially at first, because, you know, it wasn't a popular show, so they didn't have a big staff, you know, and so he's having to pick out stories all from his own life and write all these scripts. And he's like, I can't keep doing this. This is hard. And he just didn't have that ambition that I think probably executives of the time, especially, like, think of what it meant to be on NBC on a sitcom.
Oh, I mean,
the 90s.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, you know,
I'll get be begging for it.
An example from your book, the executives have one suggestion, a multi-camera production. In front of a studio audience, okay, which is sort of a typical thing for a sitcom.
Right.
David immediately hated it.
Hated it. And because it's typical. I think that's a huge part, too, is that he's also just a contrarian, right? So it's like he doesn't want to do what everybody else is doing. And that's one battle they obviously did win. And it turned out fine. But you also, I make that point partly too, because I think you feel them trying to make it the least typical studio audience multi-cam sitcom ever. And that makes a difference. That's what makes it cool and special in some ways.
One of the other things I learned from your book is like almost every single reference point throughout the series had to do with something that either happened to David and Seinfeld or the writers. Mm-hmm. And just even from the beginning, before Larry David's doing Seinfeld, he goes in for a meeting with Joe DiVola, who's an MTV executive. They wanted him for the show Remote Control. He refuses. Instead, he writes a screenplay for a movie that never gets produced called Prognosis Negative.
That's right, yes.
So he just sort of basically recycled his life. Like he got names from all these different people, not necessarily personalities, but the names and events are just taken from their lives.
It's one of my obsessions two particularly that I share with him. So I bring it up a lot in the book that he loves names. Like he just really loves a good melodic, funny sounding name. And Joe Davola was one of several that he insisted on taking from real life. Like he was a real stickler for even the down to the level of the name. And he, like, another great example is how they named Kramer after a man named Kramer. And they tried to use other names. And they just didn't like them as much as they liked the name Kramer. So they gave him a couple $100 to do it. And Davola was similar and actually signed off on. They didn't tell him what his character was going to be. And he didn't bother to ask and was a little bit surprised when he started getting scripts and saw that this was like this psychotic character. And, you know, his name lives in infamy. It was crazy. I met him on the set of One Tree Hill, you know, decades later. And he introduced himself and I was like, what? You know, and talked to him about it then. And he's one of my favorite. He's like a very funny, fun, laid back guy, too. So he has this great story about Larry David, you know, came up to him once and was like, Joe Davola, that's a great name. Can I use it? You know, and there he is. And he says he still gets, you know, great dinner reservations because people are scared of him.
Well, that's like the name Costanza. That was the name of a friend of Jerry's, Mike Costanza. Right. And immediately they just lopped onto that name.
They couldn't resist a good name. And I love that quality about them. And like, it's weird because I actually felt like there were people who even congregated around him that always had good names. There's a guy named Jeremiah Bosgang in my book.
Yeah, oh yeah.
That they didn't ever steal his name. They did steal his character for one of the NBC executives. And the minute I saw his name, I was like, I can't believe they didn't take this name. That's a great name. They really loved, I think it shows the level of their comedy that, like, you know, they're constantly looking for everything that's funny, including just a sort of fun to say name. And I don't know. I really dig that about them.
Costanza. The tryouts for George's part were phenomenal, as accounted for in your book. The people that tried out for it, Nathan Lane, Danny DeVito, Steve Buscemi, mm-hmm. David Alan mm-hmm. Greer, Brad Hall, Larry Miller. And the interesting thing is Jason Alexander's experience. He had a lot. He had stage experience.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But he also did a ton of TV commercials.
Right. Right. That's right. And just you saying that list again to me, it's like, it's unbelievable. That's like a murderer's row.
Yeah.
You could do far worse than to have an entire movie with that cast. They're also good. I think they all have been slightly different Georges. But, you know, I think in the end, who knows, they did clearly have some incredible talent for casting, because that's one of the great strengths of the show. And whatever, they couldn't have known the depths, I don't think, of Jason Alexander at the time, but they saw something. And I think he is absolutely key to this whole deal. The way that I think he commits to that role like it's a dramatic role almost. And that's why
that's
it's
right.
funny.
That's right.
You know?
And initially he was basically channeling Larry David. But then he sort of adds that extra mile to it and becomes mm-hmm. his own George Costanza. And people who read about it in your book will be surprised what an intelligent, smart, sensitive guy he is.
Yeah, that's the funny part about him is all the other part to him is that, and I actually think this is a key to his character too. Like you'd mentioned despicable characters. And I think sometimes the best terrible people that we love are played by really wonderful people. And you sense the kernel underneath. And so that's why you go with him. And I think he and Julie Louis-Dreyfus are both like this. Everything I've ever heard of them or experienced of them has been as particularly wonderful people.
Yep.
And so I think it comes through. And it's funny because I think of like Julia, especially, like she's played a string of terrible people. You know, Veep was her character was far worse on Veep. And she is the loveliest person. So it's like something's coming through that we're like, oh, this somewhere in there, there's somebody really likable. And I think Jason Alexander brought that. But it is funny that he was like a song and dance man on Broadway.
Oh, really amazing.
This.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My returning guest tonight is writer, journalist, media historian Jennifer Keeshan Armstrong. And we're talking about an incredible book. It's one of those must reads if you're a fan of the show. Seinfeldia, How a Show About Nothing changed everything. While we're on the subject of Julie Louise Dreyfus, they initially were trying to cast somebody else as the woman for the show.
That's right.
And that never worked out. That just never happened. And it was originally Lee Garlington, who I'm not that familiar with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. She was a sitcom actress, and that was, in a way, it's sort of a crushing story to me. But if you go back all the way to the pilot, you'll see that there was this character of a waitress at the diner who sort of like sparred with them.
Yeah.
And that was sort of supposed to be the woman at the time. And they didn't keep her after the first episode. And it's kind of heartbreaking, just in the sense that, imagine you were in that pilot and then it goes on without you and it becomes this thing and no one remembers you. And it's just a bummer, but this happens in sitcoms TV all the time. You'll hear these other stories in the, annals of history as well. And yeah, but it's just, they felt like after that pilot, if they were really going to go forward and they wanted a strong female character, she was going to be stuck in the diner. If it was that character, why would the waitress go out on adventures with them? She wouldn't. And so they really wanted a better presence and ended up with Julia Louis-Dreyfus playing that character instead, which again, I think is, I think those, that core cast of four, that plus Larry David is the show, that's everything. That was an incredible foursome to be, doing comedy together.
Now, what did the execs think of the pilot? It was called The Seinfeld Chronicles when it aired, sort of a one-time special.
Mm-hmm.
What Tartikoff, is really interesting. He was concerned that it was too Jewish, too New York Jewish, and too New York. And he's Jewish.
Yep. Classic. This is classic Hollywood executive. This was I could go on and on about this. There's this really strong history in Hollywood, in television in particular, of being worried about things being too Jewish. And this is the worry of a lot of Jewish executives. And this goes all the way back to the beginnings of television. There had not been a Jewish main character on television for 20 years at this point, and you have to go back to the beginning of television to find one. They were very scared of this still. It was very anti-Semitic. And so, it just, like, this was not done, and it made everybody nervous. And I think the Too New York is mostly code, but also that worry of, like, being such a coastal kind of thing. They were always worried about appealing to the Midwest, and they sort of saw themselves as very different from the viewers. Do you know what I mean?
I know what you mean.
Well, the viewers, and they didn't talk to the viewers. They just imagined what they might want. And it turned out, as we know, that's what's one of the extraordinary parts of this story, is that once they got this show in front of enough people, including the Midwest, they obviously went crazy for it, and it became one of the biggest shows of all time. I watched when I was growing up in the Midwest, and I didn't think about it at all. I just thought it was funny.
But it's interesting. Jason Alexander was also very aware and critical if it got too negatively Jewish, like one of the episodes about the Bris.
And
he originally thought the original portrayal of the Moyle was very derogatory.
Yeah, he was the most concerned, from what I can tell about this, that he's a big Jewish activist. He's very active in the Jewish community still to this day. And so he's protective, which is great. And it's funny because there's the whole question of whether his character actually is Jewish or not. that's another question, because his name is Costanza. But he was really keeping an eye out for that. And, on a show, we could talk about this in a number of ways, because this is just a show where they were always trying to push boundaries. And that can occasionally, you can trip while you're doing that.
That's right.
In terms of, certain portrayals of certain groups of people, especially if those people are not present and, able to weigh in on it. So, yeah, this was something that he was sort of always looking out for, while also wondering whether his character really was Jewish or not.
Now, you have a lot of detailed information about the writing and production and the reception of specific episodes. And some of them would take an entire show to talk about, like The Bet.
Yes.
But let's just talk about one that I find really hilarious. The Jacket.
Yeah.
Which is the one about that has Lawrence Tierney in it as Elaine's father. Now, The Jacket was really the father, was based on the father of Monica Yates. Now, who was Monica Yates?
Monica Yates was an old girlfriend of Larry's who he had become friends with. And so she was a real inspiration from minute one for Elaine's character. Like, Elaine's character kind of took on the qualities of several other real-life people over time. But this was like a kernel that he loved. He was very interested. He was kind of like amazed at himself that he could be good friends with his ex-girlfriend. She also happened to be the daughter of this incredible novelist, Richard Yates, who wrote Revolutionary Road, and was, from my understanding, like not far off from the portrayal of Elaine's father, this hyper-masculine person and very imposing.
Well, he was, when he saw the episode, the real Richard Yates saw the episode, he was furious.
Yeah, he supposedly. There's questions. I believe it was Monica herself who told me, like, she's like, I'm not sure if he was that mad or if he thought, like, the portray, like, almost like he had to portray himself a certain way. And so he watched it with a bunch. This is what I love. He watched it with a bunch of his grad students because he was teaching. And then he was like, this guy, I can't believe he, you know, very classic. It all falls in line. I love that story because it's very typical Seinfeld in that it has all of these different, like, where this funny interaction of reality and fiction, where
it really is,
you know, it's based on this real person, but then the real person has a reaction to it and it's like legendary in itself and it's incredible.
It gets weirder still. Now, Lawrence Tierney, he used to be one of the big scary stars of film noir back in the 40s and the 50s, and is obviously the Reservoir Dogs heavy. Sounds like he was a weird guy to deal with, because, you know, when you think about it, why wouldn't Elaine's father character sort of come back, like, several times? But he, like, stole a butcher knife and, like, weirded out everybody.
Yeah, that's another thing I love about this, is that it's like life and fiction and life and fiction. It was, no one was ever sure, was he kind of being real or not? Like, then it was, you know, he took out a knife from the set. There was a set, you know, like a, you know, the kitchen set had knives on it. And he sort of like took out this butcher knife and was sort of acting like he was threatening people with it. And then he was like, ha ha ha, just kidding. And everyone was like, I don't want to find out if he was really kidding by bringing him back. I find that to be a bummer, just because, yeah, that was part of, like, that was a question I had, was just like, why wouldn't this guy come back? He was such a good character and explained so much about Elaine, even.
That's right.
And, you know, and was this great, like, foil for George and Jerry. Like, it was just, I love that episode, and it's too bad, but maybe that leaves us wanting more. Maybe that's good. We can always just hold it in our memories fondly.
When you write, especially in the beginning, like in mid-season 1991, they would write episodes that would drive the executives up the frickin' wall. And a great example is the Chinese restaurant episode. They sat in on the read, the execs did, and Bosgang really started thinking, well, this is nothing. This is a show about nothing. Mm-hmm. Seinfeld and David can't hack it as long-term comedian writers, because this show is about nothing. And they put it on, and it's a favorite episode.
Yeah, it's a huge turning point in the show. And, you know, it's because it was not a typical sitcom script at all. Like, the way that I think Jeremy may have even explained it to me at the time was like, it's like, what are we supposed to put in this, like, TV guide synopsis? You know what I mean? Like, they go to a Chinese restaurant, they wait for a table, they don't get one. That's the synopsis? And this just wasn't done before. And, you know, Jeremiah Bosgang was like the junior executive on this. And I think he was a little nervous still, too, because it's like not a hit yet. And so he goes to boss, Rick Ludwin, and he's like, can they do this? And they were really, it was one of the few times they were like, you can't do this. And that's when Larry said, well, forget it, then I'm not doing the show. And they were like, fine, do it, we'll see. And critics especially, this was a big critical moment in particular, which can help a show that's kind of struggling, where they all saw it, and I agree, and sort of saw Waiting for Godot.
Well, you know, even people who were acting in the episode, James Hong, one of the great actors, mm-hmm. He had trepidations about the episode because it just,
what are we doing?
Nothing's happening.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is one, definitely the director Tom Sharonis, in general at the beginning, who had, you know, some sitcom experience. In general, he was always looking at these scripts and going like, what is this? I don't know what this is, but sure, it looks fun, like I'll do it, but even a lot of people involved with the show were kind of like, I'm not sure if this is brilliant or crazy, but that's why it just teetered on this line between like, it's not big enough for us to worry about, you know, the executives. And like, by the time it becomes big, it has found its footing creatively so much that then you get to, you know, later episodes that would have been questioned if it was a different show, like The Bet, you know, and
yeah, absolutely.
You know, that's, and by that time they were so huge that they thought that they would be questioned on an episode about masturbation. And instead the executives were like, you do you, you're doing great.
Except you can't say the word, you can't say the word masturbation.
Right. They did. I mean, part of what I think is brilliant about that episode is the fact that they don't say it. But still, you know, this was one where Friends always had sort of the rivalry with them, and the Friends people were complaining like, we can't show a condom wrapper, but these people can do this episode. And the thing is, they were just so overwhelmingly popular, especially with what NBC had been struggling with, which was young people, that NBC by this time was like, look, whatever you're doing, just keep doing it because we are enjoying the money that you are printing for us. So
we've only scratched the surface of this book because, you know, partway through the series, Larry David leaves. Although he keeps making appearances as George Steinbrenner.
That's right.
Also,
that's right.
He appears as the man in the cape, but he has no speaking role. But he comes in to write and direct the infamous last episode, but we've completely out of time. So we can't talk about it, and you're going to have to read it in the book. My returning guest tonight is writer, journalist, media historian, Jennifer Keeshan Armstrong. And we're talking about her book, Seinfeldia, How a Show About Nothing Changed Everything. And it really, really did. And you need to read this book to understand why. Jennifer, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you for having me.
You listen to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.